to learn Masachas Ksubis
together. And they say learn Masachas Ksubis kind of in a general sense without even identifying a parak. I think that's essentially the way to view it. That Masachas Ksubis, we have an official yeshiva parak, the third parak, and hopefully we'll have a lot of exposure to that. But we're going to try to take it also a little bit more holistically. That essentially Ksubis is really a very special opportunity. Ksubis is sometimes referred to, if you've heard this expression, it's called Shas Katan, correct? The idea that it kind of is a microcosm of the entire Talmud, that you find within Ksubis themes and sugyas and topics that span the whole gamut. And you get exposed to Kol HaTorah Kula from a Lamdisha perspective, from maybe a Halachic perspective a little bit. It's interesting, if you learn the first parak, there's many very important sugyas about Tochos Shabbos we were learning last year. There's all kinds of themes and ideas in Maseches Ksubis, which is a tremendous plus, but it could also pose a specific kind of challenge, that it makes it feel as if Ksubis is thematically very scattered, maybe very disconnected, and you feel like you're hitting all kinds of different themes. And sometimes you'd rather feel that you have one kind of unifying idea and theme and topic that you're focused on. And the truth is, I think if you look under the surface, that is true about Ksubis. Ksubis does have a unifying theme, unifying connections, which we'll try to bring out. So we're going to try very hard to kind of keep our eye on the ball as far as that's concerned, try to be aware of the threads that bring the whole Masechta together, while at the same time, we'll take advantage of the opportunity to see all the different ideas and all the different concepts that are presented in the Masechta, but try to maintain an awareness. And it takes a little effort, as we see, that the first few prakim, which are really what's on our agenda, at least for this semester, it's a challenge to see how they all come together and how they connect. But the truth is, they do. And we'll try to make that clearer. We'll try to be able to focus and direct our attention to how the ideas come together. And in that sense, the yeshiva is officially focused on the third parak, and we want to see a lot of the third parak too. But I think it's important, we'll start the third parak this morning. If you saw the Marmakomos, it's the first thing. But we'll use that really in the context of an introduction to all of Maseches Ksubis, or at least to the major themes of Maseches Ksubis. And then, I'm guessing that'll probably take us a day or two, because we have shorter shirim today and tomorrow, probably today and tomorrow. And then after that, we'll back up a little bit. We'll start from the second parak, and hopefully take a running start into the third parak. But from the second parak, it'll give us an opportunity to see a real diversity of sugyas. We'll see really many different themes that really span the entire Shas. Those of you who were here 2 years ago and learned stuff about Metzia, first parak, there's a lot of overlap, and in the beginning of the second parak, Ksubis, the issues of Nigo and Pesha Asar, things like that we'll see. And Moda Mimiksa, certain themes, if you're familiar with that. If you're not, don't worry, we'll go over it. But there's a lot that's very relevant in the second parak, both the Ksubis issues and Kol HaTorah Kula. And there are also many diverse sugyas. We'll talk about Simchas Chasim and Kala, all kinds of different topics that we'll be able to get a little bit exposed to by backing up a little bit. So that'll be essentially our plan, that probably a day or two on an introduction, starting from Mishnah in the third parak, and then kind of backing it up to start from the second parak. And I think that'll really give us an opportunity really have a very rich experience and really see a lot. And that should hopefully take us through this semester, the second and the third parak issues. And I would hope for the second semester, even though plans sometimes change, what I have in mind is all the very important issues of Ishus, the obligations practically of a husband to wife to each other, and the related unfortunate issue of divorces and gittin and what is involved. I'm sure you're all aware of some of the current controversies and issues that come up in terms of what justifies forcing a divorce, things like that, some of the very sensitive contemporary topics. A lot of that is also very much ksubis related. It sounds like it's getting related, but it's also really ksubis related. And God willing, a vision for the second semester to kind of address the sugyas in the second half of the Masechta, which address those themes and hopefully will give us a little bit more insight into how Jewish marriages work and how they're supposed to work. Any questions about any of that? Any suggestions? Any comments? Okay, so let's try to get a little bit of an understanding of some of the themes in Maseches Ksubis. So Ksubis requires having a little bit of an understanding about some fundamentals of Jewish marriage. It requires a little bit of an introduction that's also Kiddushin related. Even though we're not learning Kiddushin, we're learning Ksubis, but we have to have a little bit of a background in Kiddushin to understand how they connect to each other. So we'll just say a few words about that. But first, to look at this Mishnah in the third parak. What's the topic of the third parak of Ksubis? What does the Mishnah start off talking about? Doesn't seem to be so related to marriage on the surface, but it may be that the theme of this Mishnah is particularly relevant to everything else the Masechta is all about. Even though it's not at all obvious from the Mishnah how that is, that's something hopefully we'll see today, maybe even a little bit more tomorrow, how the theme of this Mishnah, in kind of a roundabout way, takes us into a very fundamental concept of what Ksubis is about. So what is the ostensible theme of the Mishnah in the third parak, the first Mishnah in the third parak? Knas, right? And the knas that applies, unfortunately, a situation of rape. It's not a pleasant topic, but the Mishnah starts off talking about a concept that we'll read about next week in Parshas Kisetze, that if a woman is, raped, so then the Torah imposes a dual structured penalty. Right? And on the one hand, he has to be ready to marry her. That's to the modern eye, to the modern ear, it sounds like a crazy idea. Why would any woman want that? And indeed, the assumption is not that she necessarily would want that, in the Torah's view as well. She's not obligated to enter into that relationship. But the concern is that she may find herself now in a position where there's no one who's going to marry her and take care of her. So if that's the case, so she has the right to demand that he marry her, and he doesn't have the right to say no. And we force him to do that. The Gemara is a little bit later in Maseches Ksubis. We'll talk about that. Again, seems like a little bit of a shocking concept that anyone would want that. And the expectation is not necessarily that she would, but in case that she does, so this is his obligation. And together with that, he also has an obligation of a knas. So this concept of knas, the Torah connects these two related themes, that on the one hand, this sugya of ones is what's found in Parshas Kisetze and Sefer Dvarim and Parachav Beis. Many of you noticed the first typo of the year. I got it in early just to make sure there are no illusions about the absence of typos. So the second Mar Makom was already printed with a typo. That's Pasuk Chav Ches and Chav Tes in Perek Chav Beis. That part was left out. But some of you got some interesting tours through the Tochacha in order to find it. Maybe that's also just an intentional Elul theme. You never know. There's no mistakes. Everything has a plan. But in any event, so that's connected to Perichot Beis and Shmos. Perichot Beis and Shmos, so the Torah tells us that there is also a knas. It's a little bit different, but it's similar, that if the physical relationship took place not through rape necessarily, but through pitui, which we translate, let's say, as seduction, so then there is a knas. It doesn't have the same concept as the chiyuv marriage. It has the knas part. And in that context, the Torah says, kesef yishkol, right? You shall take money to pay a fine, a kemohar habesuos. So that phrase, as we'll see, is going to be very significant in the Maseches Ksubis, and we will come back to that. So with that opening, so now let's take a step back for a moment and talk about the whole concept of Jewish marriage. And like we said, it has to first start with a little bit of a reference to Maseches Kedusha. Just a few minutes of themes from that Masechta. So the Torah also tells us in next week's parasha that there is a concept of marriage. Ki yikach ish isha, when a man should take a wife, we'll use that phrase for now. So that notion of ki, it's a question how to read that. The Rambam understands it, as does Sefer HaChinuch, that this constitutes a mitzvah. There is a mitzvah to take a wife in a formal process known as Kiddushin. And the act of Kiddushin, if you're familiar with the Mishnah in the beginning of Maseches Kiddushin, the first Mishnah in Kiddushin, the Mishnah says there are three ways to do that. Taisha nikneis b'shlosh shenochin. The three ways are kesef, shtar, ubiya. Right, nowadays we only do really one of those. It's kesef, that we use a monetary kinyan in order to effect kiddushin. The other two we don't use for various reasons. In terms of biya, the idea that the physical relationship could be a kinyan kiddushin. So the Gemara says that's technically true, but the Gemara says in Yevamos that it's highly discouraged, it's not considered to be proper. The Gemara talks about receiving malchus for using this method of kedushin. It's a possibility, but it's not an appropriate way to do things. It may, after the fact, cause kinyan, which is a whole separate discussion. Again, we're not focused on Maseches Kedushin, but that's one of the kinyanim. Shtar is not ksubis. And so we might think, okay, shtar, okay, that's what we're going to talk about in this Masechta, the contract. So the shtar that's talked about in the Mishnah and Kedushin is different than the ksuba. That is a certain model, which again we don't see nowadays, but the same way that a marriage is ended with a shtar, with a get, so theoretically one could use a shtar to effect the Kedushin as well, and that would be different than the ksuba. That's not what the ksuba does. But that's also not our practice. Our practice is to use kesef. And we also do it a little bit differently. We don't use cash, but we use what's known as shoveh kesef, something that's worth money. So the minhag has developed to use a ring. And the man gives the woman a ring, and that effects kiddushin. And the Rambam explains, the Rambam has a lot to say about this. The Rambam, by the way, so on today's Marmakomo, so in terms of the Ksubas topics, so much of the 10th parak of Hilchos Ishus is very relevant to some of the things we'll see in the next day or two. Instead of just asking you to read it straight, they highlighted a few halachos in the 10th parak of Ksubas, the 10th parak of Ishus, rather, excuse me, that's about Ksuba topics. But first, in the very beginning of Hilchos Ishus, so the Rambam says that this is a mitzvah saseh, this Kiddushin. And he explains it that the idea is that Kodem Matan Torah, before the Torah came along and told us how we should live our lives in a more appropriate way, so Hayadam Bokei Isha B'Shuk, a man would just meet a woman in the marketplace and they decide to be together, and there is no formality to it. And then comes the Torah and says that's not right, that first there has to be a formal process. There has to be an act of commitment. And that's what the Kiddushin effects. And it's very striking that the Rambam also, when he talks about this in Sefer HaMitzvos, you saw that in the Marmakomos, and he alludes to this a little bit also in his introduction to Hilchos Ishus, at the very beginning of Sefer Nashim, he lists the mitzvos. You see it's referred to there as well. The Rambam understands that this is a mitzvah saseh, this is a positive mitzvah, and he also understands that there is a lo saseh involved. That if a man and woman were to have a physical relationship, and there would not be a process of kiddushin, so that would be an isser in the Torah of kiddushin. Right? The Torah prohibits being a kiddushin, which we often translate sometimes it's translated into English as something along the lines of a prostitute, of a harlot, something like that. And that's how some of the Rishonim understand it. Some of the Rishonim do understand it as somebody who's more described by that kind of terminology. But the Rambam's not the view of all the Rishonim, but the Rambam's understanding is that even a male and female in a committed one-on-one relationship would also constitute a violation of this Isser if there is no Kiddushin. And it's interesting, he explains, why does the Torah have to give a losaseh? Why does the Torah have to give us a specific prohibition? He says, that's really because of our Mishnah here in Eilon Iris. That's really because of the whole concept of knas. Yes, sir?
According to the Rambam, is such a losaseh classified as one of the arayos?
No. So that's also an important point. We'll get to that a little bit in general about the question of arayos. That arayos is not the same thing as a prohibited physical relationship. It's a certain category, and that it has to rise to a certain level. It's machlokas in the Gemara elsewhere as to what type of prohibitions rise to that level. But for example, the way we paskin, let's say, for example, a kohen and a grusha are prohibited to marry each other, but that doesn't rise to the level of arayos. So one of the ingredients is that it has to have an isser karis associated with it. And that might also not be enough. It was a machlokas, so for example, if a woman is a nida, so that's an isser karis. But that, it's a machlokas rishonim, we generally tend to assume that's also not called arayis in the classical sense. That it has to be something that's more definitive about the relationship. That there has to be something inherent in this relationship, like, let's say, a brother and sister. You know, let's say they're related biologically too closely. Or if the woman is married, so she is forbidden to the whole world. So that's what creates not just an isser kares, but a fundamental impossibility in the relationship. But in general, when you have, let's say, the way most of Rishonim understand it, you have nida. So nida is an isser kares, but it's not that this man and woman are fundamentally prohibited to each other. So most of Rishonim understand that doesn't constitute arayas. And especially, all the more so, if they happen not to have married each other, and there's no kares associated with this specific isser, that wouldn't be considered something that rises to the level of arayos.
In that case, an unmarried man forced a woman at gunpoint to sleep with him,
mm-hmm.
that would not be
a haridvah yavor. Wouldn't be a haridvah yavor, probably not. It would be definitely ma'anis. It would probably not be a haridvah yavor, right? On her part, you're saying she shouldn't. Are you saying that she shouldn't have to? Right. It would seem like that. Yes, sir.
So the law is referring to extramarital sex, whether or not there's compensation.
Well, that's actually the point. It says it's dafka, the compensation, that creates the necessity for the law. And that's an interesting point that he goes on to explain. So why is it that the Torah needs to come and tell us a prohibition here? So we said, okay, we have a mitzvah of kiddushin. What's the role of the law? He said that. Says the Rambam, the issue is that the knas could be misleading. And that could get us into a serious conceptual problem. That since the Torah says that in the case of rape and seduction, so there is a knas, so one might get the impression that that's essentially the whole story. That there's nothing else wrong with it other than the need to pay the knas. And that would be a very serious mistake. It's interesting, you know, they did a study, if you ever read the book Freakonomics, I think it's in that book, or it's not, it's in a very similar book. So I think the beginning, the first chapter, I think, in Freakonomics, talks about, it happens to be, it was a story that took place in Israel, by coincidence. But they discussed that there was, sorry?
This wasn't the beginning.
Right, the school in Haifa?
Yeah.
Right, so the school in Haifa that had a problem that the parents weren't picking, it was a daycare center, that the parents were not picking up the kids on time. So the staff had to wait around forever for the parents to show up. So they thought, okay, how are they going to solve this problem? They'll put a monetary penalty, and if you don't come on time to pick up your children, you have to pay a knas. So what happened? What was the result of making that penalty? Did it solve their problem?
The
problem got worse. The parents started coming later. Why did they come later? Because once there was this monetary penalty, so they felt like, okay, so they're paying for it. So when they didn't pay a penalty, they felt guilty. So at least they had that factor that they felt they're keeping the staff waiting. All right, they're doing something wrong, doing something morally wrong. So at least that'll push them a little bit. But once they paid the penalty, they felt, okay, it's like a circus. I can pay for to come a little bit extra. And they didn't have any guilt anymore. So the problem got worse. It ended up exacerbating the issue. So that's essentially what the Rambam says. You could have that mentality here as well, that there needs to be a knas, but you shouldn't get the sense that the knas is what makes it okay, that that's the only issue, that the lack of knas is the only problem. The lack of monetary restitution is the only problem. So since the Torah tells you to pay the restitution, that solves everything. So then you may come to the conclusion that, okay, if it's okay with everybody involved, so and we don't even have to insist on the knas, so then there's nothing to be worried about. So the presence of the knas could give you this wrong impression, could make you think that as long as you settle the monetary issues, there's nothing else. So therefore, the Torah has to come and say, no, that's not the case. The knas is there, that's a side issue, but there's something fundamentally wrong here, that this relationship has to be a respectful relationship, and you don't have the right to say, don't worry about it, and I'll pay the fine, or I'll be mochel the fine either way, and dispense with all that. That's very much not the point. So therefore, says the Rambam, this has to be there. It's interesting, the Rambam in Mor Nevuchim, so he also gives additional perspective as to why he thinks this is important. You know, on the one hand, so it seems like where the way he's describing in Mishnah Torah, that the Torah is telling us that the physical relationship between a man and a woman has to be a serious, formal thing. It shouldn't be something that is casual without any sense of responsibility. And if this relationship is going to exist, it has to first come with a degree of commitment and specificity and designation. And in Mor Nevuchim, he adds a few more perspectives to it. It's interesting, especially in light of current social trends. So one of the issues he discusses in Mor Nevuchim talks about potential children. So we know nowadays we talk about the crisis of uninvolved fathers and things like that and how that contributes to all kinds of social problems. So the Rambam talks about this in Mor Nevuchim. Now it's also interesting to contrast that we know that in halacha we have a concept of mamzerus, which does not really translate so well into English. Into English they translate it as illegitimate children, but it's not really the same kind of usage. Because in halacha, a mamzer is a product of, as you mentioned before, an erva, of a forbidden relationship. It's not the product of two parents who are not married to each other. If a man and a woman are not married to each other, they have a child, that does not create mamzerus. In contemporary society, we use that word to mean the child out of wedlock, a child of two unmarried parents. But in halacha, that doesn't create mamzerus. But it doesn't mean it's irrelevant. So that's what the Rambam says in Mor Nevuchim. You know, it may not be mamzerus, but it's a problem. It's an emotional problem. It's a social problem. You don't want children born, and they don't know who their fathers are. They don't have any connection to their fathers. Their father's not connected to the mother. That's not such an ideal situation. So if you have a physical relationship which could produce children, so we want the father to have a commitment to the mother. That's what's necessary for stability of the family, for the children, and for their emotional health and the like. So the Rambam in Mor Nevuchim, he says that's one of the reasons why he thinks that's the case. The Torah is saying if there's going to be a physical relationship, the two have to have this commitment to each other. Are you?
So if a legitimate child, but the father was a kohen, so you're saying the kid would still be a kohen?
Yeah.
Full-fledged, basically, does everything?
Yeah, assuming that the mother is not a mother that the father is not allowed to be with.
I'm saying, as long as it was...
You know, it also gets a little bit of a question in terms of the Rishonim, because the relationship itself, you have to figure out, theoretically, it depends on the Rambam's definition of Kadesha. You know, what exactly is the status of a mother who has had physical relationships with outside the context of marriage? But pashtus is that doesn't necessarily, at least halacha lemaisa, doesn't necessarily asher her to a kohen. So then the son should also be a kohen. But we can explore that topic a little bit more. But whatever the halachic ramifications, the Rambam is saying, socially, emotionally, it's damaging to have children who are not going to have any knowledge who their fathers are, not going to have any relationship between the parents. So there has to be a commitment. And it's interesting, as we'll see when we talk about ksubas a little bit more. So this is not necessarily even to exclude a divorce situation. It's to say that there has to at least start with a commitment. And that's already fundamentally different, even if the parents, that's part of what Maseches Ksubas is about. Right, it's also about addressing what happens after the marriage, that even if the parents are no longer together, but at least they start with a certain degree of commitment to each other, that already fundamentally changes the picture as far as any children are involved. The Rambam also talks about the fact that if you have the potential for a woman to have children from many different men, it's also not the healthiest thing in the world, and it's also, it's bad for the woman, it's bad for the children, it's bad for Shalom. You can imagine what kind of fights happen when that kind of situation is going on. So for all these reasons, in the Mar Nevuchim, he adds to the picture that he paints in the Mishneh Torah, that this is not good for society to have physical relationships outside the context of a formalized commitment, and therefore he sees this as a mitzvah. Now, it's worth discussing for a moment. It's also a very sensitive topic. So the whole idea of kinyan, right, the whole notion that there is a formal process which we normally talk about in the context of acquisition, so that also deserves a little bit of discussion, because it creates the impression as if the man is purchasing the woman, as if that's what's going on in the Torah's conception of marriage. I don't think that's at all what's going on. I think that what's happening is there is a lot of overlap, but for a different reason. That essentially what the Torah is telling us, if you follow this whole train of thought, that the Torah is saying, the way the Rambam just told us, that the requirement of Kiddushin is that the relationship between the two of them should happen in the context of commitment and seriousness. It shouldn't be casual. It shouldn't be just a fling that doesn't involve any type of commitment to each other. So if that's the case, if the Torah is saying, all right, you have to be serious and you have to be committed, so then the process of kinyan that is factored in here, what's the role of the kinyan? So yes, it's the same mechanism that you find elsewhere in the Torah to acquire property. But that doesn't mean that's what's happening here. It means that we want a process of seriousness. So where do you find seriousness in our interactions with each other? So we have a concept of a kinyan. If you want to transfer property, if you want to buy an object, so in order to do that, you need some type of indication that there is an agreement between the two parties. We need something to indicate that this is actually changing hands. So we need an expression of seriousness. So a kinyan is an expression of seriousness. So too, when we're talking about seriousness that's required to enter into a marriage relationship, so if we want some tool of seriousness, something that expresses commitment, so we use the methodology of kinyan that you find in this other realm, and that's what teaches us how you express seriousness in this realm as well. But it doesn't mean that there's a kinyan taking place on the person. It means that this is a tool of seriousness, and we use the same tool in both areas of life. We use it in the area of mekach u'memka, we use it in business, and we use it in creating this family relationship. In both places, it's the same tools, but it's not doing the same thing. And just to illustrate that with, say, 2 points, one, the Rishonim asked. So the Rishonim asked in the beginning of Maseches Kiddushin, when the Mishnah lists off the kinyanim that are used for Kiddushin. So some of them do come from the area of business. So the Rishonim asked, so why don't we take other kinyanim from business? So for example, we have a concept called Hagbah. Think that you can make a kinyan on something by lifting it up, neshicha, by drawing it towards you. So why don't we use that? Right? Carry her over the threshold, that should be the kinyan. Right? Why don't we say that should lift up the kala, that should be the process of kinyan. So the Rishonim explained that, no, that doesn't work, because you're not being kona the kala. You know, when you're being kona an object, so then you pick up that object, this is what the kinyan is on. But here, the kinyan is not on the woman. The kinyan is the relationship. The kinyan is a tool to affect the seriousness of the relationship. So you don't have the same type of model. There isn't really anything to lift up, because there is no dover ha-niknes. There isn't that same type of structure. It's merely using the tool of kinyan in order to affect the seriousness of the relationship, not that you are acquiring her in that same sense. Hi. Sorry? There are monetary implications, but that's not on her. And we'll see, that's more a ksubas topic, as we'll see, that there's a reciprocal relationship. And if you saw the later comments the Rambam has, we'll talk more about that, I'll probably get to it a little bit more tomorrow, that it's a reciprocal relationship in terms of how the monetary rights go. But it's not that you buy her and you get everything with her. So even if you did, it still wouldn't be...
You're not buying her, but you're gonna, I guess, gaining access to her.
And she's gaining access to...
Right, exactly. Right.
It's a merger.
There's not like a kinyan taking place over that because of that?
It's a function of that kinyan. You become related in this marital relationship, and that marital relationship has monetary implications. But it doesn't mean that you're...
not on her or herself.
Correct.
It's, her, like, it's things that come with her.
Right. And I'll just illustrate another point. Hi.
Does Bia... How does Bia fit in with this? Because if it's okay on biblical, then why was it not recommended by the rabbis, by the rabbi?
So, in general, an expression of kinyan, an expression of seriousness that we find in other areas of halacha, is that you act as if it's already true. Right? So, for example, you find when it comes to karka, right, karka has the same first two, a karka nicknames bekesef shtar u bechazaka. What does chazaka mean in that context? It means you live in the house. It means that you take...
Squatted already.
Something like that. Well, that's actually not exactly like that, but it's a little more complicated. But something along those lines, you act as if it's already true. I used to theorize that's why I tend to fall asleep Friday night during Kabbalah Shabbos. It's a Kenyan on Shabbos, and you act as if it's already, you act as if it's already Shabbos. So it was a magic. As soon as Kabbalah Shabbos is dark, boom, it's the Kenyan. So too, but here, it's not appropriate. Here, this is not a derech heuristic way to do it. So technically, it's a way of showing commitment, of showing, and this is what you intend to do, but it's also very non-sneistic and a lot of other problems, so the Gemara says not the way to do it, but on some level it's technically true. But just to illustrate another way, how you see the Kenyan is not on the kala, but there is a machlokus in general about really a different topic, but it draws a proof from here. So we have a concept, b'chol Torah kula, of a Kenyan kesef. So let's say, for example, you buy a house. You could buy a house with a Kenyan Kesef. If you've ever been a part of, if you ever watch Mechiras Chametz on Erev Pesach, so you get a crash course in Kenyanim. You see that we try to get as many Kenyanim in as possible. We want to make sure that it's really sold effectively. So if you ever witness that, you see a lot of Kenyanim taking place. And one of the Kenyanim that's used there is a Kenyan Kesef. So what does a Kenyan Kesef mean? What does it mean in any area? It means that you give, let's say, a coin, you give some small amount of money to the seller, and that affects the transaction. So it's a machlokas among the later svar, on the side of the page of the Shulchan Aruch, the Taz and the Sma and others, they talk about what's this supposed to represent. Let's say I buy a house, the house costs $1 million, and I use a quarter to make the kinyan on the house, to make a kinyan kesef on the house. So how should we view that? Is that, now clearly I have to pay for the house also. Right? When you buy an object, so the payment is separate from the kinyan. The kinyan transfers the property, and you still have to pay for it. So that creates a debt. You have a debt to pay for the value of the item, but the kinyan is the actual transfer. So let's say I use a quarter to buy $1 million house. So now I got to pay for the rest. So how does it work? Is it that I paid the quarter as a down payment and now I owe $999,999.75? Or is it, no, it's not even a down payment. I owe $1 million because the kesef, this quarter, is not a down payment at all. It's a symbolic transaction. This is a way of effecting seriousness. It's a way of symbolizing seriousness. That's how some understood all kinyanim, which is basically symbolic. It's all a way of just representing to the outside world that there is seriousness here. So the giving over of the quarter is to do that. But it's not even a down payment. It doesn't connect at all to the value of the house. It's not connected at all to the payment of the money. So the Sma, on the side of the page, the bottom of the page of the Shulchan Aruch, the Sma says, clearly it's symbolic. It can't be a down payment. You know how you know it's not a down payment? I'll prove to you it's not a down payment. Because when else do we use the Kenyan Kesef? Right, we use it for Kiddushin. Right? That's the first one of the options. That's the one we actually do. Right? Aisha nicknames the Kesef Shtar of Bia. So we use the ring as a Kenyan Kesef. So you're going to tell me in that context it's a payment of value? The term is a Kesef Shivya and it's part of the value? Obviously not. She's priceless. Right? So it's not that this is a part of a payment towards the woman. This is a symbolic entrance into a relationship. So just like in that context, the giving of the coin is meant as a symbolism. It's not meant as any type of a merchandise value type of purchase. So too, it's the same Kenyan Kesef in other areas of halacha. So you have to say that's what it is everywhere, and it's not at all any kind of a down payment or any connection to value. Hi.
So if all Kenyanim are symbolic and expressions of seriousness, mm-hmm. I understand that correct?
I think so.
Then if if that's also what the point of canyoning on marriage is, it's also acquiring a woman. There's no difference between becoming an object and becoming a woman.
No, there is. The purpose of the seriousness is different. It's just a kinyan is a tool of seriousness. And sometimes that seriousness is there to express whatever the two parties are agreeing to. So in a business context, I'm selling you something, so I need seriousness to show that I'm selling you this. But in the context of a marriage, they're creating a family relationship, so we need seriousness to show that that's the case. So it doesn't have the same effect, it's a tool to that end. So, hi.
Doesn't the Tav say that by Kiddushin, monetary payment is not just a symbolic payment, but actually a...
So that's what the Smaz is arguing on, right? That's how
the Taz says the
right, so it sounds like the Taz... Right,
also,
so that's you have to figure out exactly what the Taz means, practically speaking. I think the Smaz is more compelling from this angle because the mechanics simply don't work. It simply doesn't seem to fit into an understandable model, and that's where it seems to be that this is the answer, that this is a relationship kinyan rather than a kestiv shivyon, is the language that the Chazanish talks about this. So, in any event, you find this, just maybe we'll mention this point, let's see how much time I have, but it's a little bit of a, just more of a mystery point, but, you know, it's interesting because there is this whole delicate balance a little bit between the technical, business-like aspects of marriage, which a lot of Maseches Ksubos is about, and that is there. As Adam was saying, you know, clearly there is a monetary relationship that comes along with this. So that's clearly a part of it. And the whole idea that the relationship itself is using a mechanism of kinyan. So it creates a certain overlap with business, but at the same time, it's a model that breaks down. It's something that we have to be aware of where its limits are. So it's just, I'll just mention it. I get to talk about this sometimes in the business class. So if you take that class, you'll hear it there also. But it's an interesting question. We have a prohibition of onah in halacha, that if you misrepresent the value of something, if you misrepresent whether or not an item that you're selling is complete, so that's what we call a mekach tos. If you sell something under pretenses that are not accurate, the other party gets the wrong idea and wouldn't otherwise enter into this purchase, that's called a mekach tos. So that does have a parallel here, that to that extent it's an idea that carries over, that theoretically is a very complex topic, and it's more a second half Ksubos topic, and we'll get to it in a little more detail. But theoretically, if there's a fundamental misrepresentation in a marriage, where, let's assume for now, either party wouldn't have entered into the marriage had they known this. There was something fundamental that was concealed. So you have, again, that concept of mekach tos, that the kinyan was not really with full awareness, and therefore it gets undone. It's null and void. So some of the Achronim ask, okay, so fine. So we have this parallel between the two. In both cases, the kinyan could be a mistake in such a way that it undermines the whole idea. It's null and void. So carrying that further, so what about Gnevas Das? We have a concept also that if you mislead someone, let's say in a business context too, it's possible to deceive somebody in a way that doesn't actually create monetary loss. So it's not automatically reversed, it's not a mekach tos, but it's still an issue. So if I sell you an item, say if I sell you a car, and I tell you the car is worth $2,000, and I charge you $2,000 for it, and it's only worth $1,000. So then that could be a mekach tos. I made you pay $2,000 for a car, it's not worth it. You wouldn't have bought this car had you known it's only worth $1,000. But let's say I deceive you in a way that wouldn't have changed your mind. Let's say I tell you that the car is worth $2,000, but I'll sell it to you for $1,000. And it really is worth $1,000. And you pay $1,000. So you pay the correct amount, and you would have bought it either way. But I made you think that it's better. I made you think that you should be grateful to me for giving you a good deal. Here's this $2,000 car for $1,000. So it's not monetary deception. But that's an isser. That's deception in a different way. And that's an isser called Gnevas Das. So some of the Achronim say, we have a problem. Because how can anyone ever date? mean, if you're going to date, so nobody ever tells the other side everything about themselves. They have to tell them the things that are crucially important, you know, the things that affect their decision about whether to get married or not. But we all have all kinds of imperfections that if you mentioned every single imperfection during your dating experience, you'd never get married for that reason, because they'll think you're crazy. Right? So how do you avoid, the Stipler and others asked this question, how do you avoid the issue of gneivas das? Okay, you're not withholding something that would have affected the decision, but you are giving a false impression. So if in business that would be a problem, right? If we would say that in business, if you would conceal some flaw, even if they would have bought it anyway, that's a violation of gneivas das. So why is that not true in dating? And if it is true, how does anyone ever date? So the answer to that, there's different answers to this, but it seems to illustrate the point that this merchandise model ultimately breaks down. That there is some connection to the business world as far as some of the basic mechanics here, but ultimately you're not dealing with merchandise, you're dealing with people. So this is why, for example, the Klausenberger Rebbe wrote in his Chuvus, he said that he thinks that there's essentially a minig to not pay attention to these things, that we recognize nobody would ever get married if they're going to be makbid on every little detail and treated like a business deal. And therefore, we don't relate to it that way. We don't relate to it like a business transaction. And Stipler said it a little bit differently. Stipler in a Sefer Nevamos, he said that, okay, let's say, for example, I sell you this car, and I tell you it's perfect, and it turns out it's not perfect. The radio's broken. So it's not a difference that would make you regret the sale. You would have bought it anyway. Right? So you're not going to come bring back the car. But I say, listen, I feel bad that I told you that the radio's broken. I told you the radio's good and it's broken. You know what? I'm going to take back the car. I'll give you one with a perfect radio. I'll trade it for you and I'll give you exactly what you want. Okay, then you'd probably accept it. Now, you wouldn't have come back and returned the car on your own, but you'd accept it. Now, let's try to transfer that to people. Let's say I say, all right, you've been happily married for 15 years. Okay, you're very happy with your wife. Well, there's one thing you didn't know about. Okay, fine, but you don't regret the marriage. You're very happy you did it. So I'll call you up and say, you know what? I'm going to trade your wife. I'll give you the perfect version that doesn't have this problem. Right? So you laugh because it doesn't make sense. In real life, it doesn't work that way. You're dealing with human beings. There is no such thing. So that's essentially illustrative of the point that, yes, on some level, there is a surface connection to the concept of a transaction. And it is true that material misrepresentation would have the same type of effect as it would in the business world. The whole deal would be null and void. But at the end of the day, you're talking about human beings. The comparison falls apart if you take it too far. And that can't be ultimately the way that you actually relate to your marriage. So in the external surface, you start off with, yes, certain trappings of business and arrangements and technicalities and Ksubis, that's what the whole Masechta ultimately is about, protecting certain external monetary considerations and practical considerations. But at the heart of it, so there is this seriousness, and the heart of it, it's about this relationship between the two people, and that can't be at its core something that's so defined by this business model. It's an important balance to keep in mind. So in any event, so much more time, we'll just... we'll say another two words about this, and we'll continue this tomorrow. We'll try to get to Menachon time, which the review we spoke about. So essentially, what do we see? So you have the Rambam. The Rambam maintains that this is a mitzvah saseh, and that failure to go through the process of kedushin before entering into a physical relationship constitutes a violation of a lav. Constitutes a violation of the Isser of Kedesha. Now, other Rishonim had a different understanding. Other Rishonim understood that the mitzvah may not necessarily exist as a mitzvah per se, that the Rush, for example, the Rush in the first Perek of Ksubis doesn't understand Kedushin to be an individual mitzvah, he understands it to be a Hechsher mitzvah. So as the Torah has a mitzvah of Puravu, you have a mitzvah to have children and populate the world. So presumably in order to do that, you're going to have to get married first. So therefore, Kedushin constitutes a Hechsher mitzvah, a mitzvah in the sense that it's something you have to do in order to do something else, But it isn't a mitzvah in and of itself. While the Rambam in the Sefer Achinuch seem to maintain that it is a mitzvah, and also the Ritva in his commentary to the first parak of Ksubas, the Ritva writes that the Birchas Erusin that's recited under the Chuppah, that constitutes a Birchas HaMitzvah. So it seems like you have this range of views whether Kiddushin is a mitzvah or not. But the Rambam's position is very important, especially as we understand how it relates to our Masechta, that sets this concept down. That first we have this idea of creating a seriousness in the relationship. The idea the Gemara says in Masechta's Kiddushin, that Beis and Beis, if you saw this Gemara, that it creates a hektish. The word Kiddushin seems to flow from the idea of sanctity. Right, ironically, it's related to the word Kadesha, but essentially means the opposite. Right, that this individual is designated. And then Tosfos over there comments also, if you saw that, it was on the Marmar Komos also. Tosfos also highlights that this is not a language that would work in a Kenyan. Right, that there is, again, a breakdown in the model. It's not something that really correlates to merchandise. So if you wanted to buy a talis, as Tosfos says, you wouldn't be able to say that this talis, haray ha talis, mekudeshesli. You can't use that language. That mekudeshes is specific to this relationship between the man and the woman, and it signifies, as the Gemara says over there, the also kuli amalig hektish, that the language hektish in general represents something that is designated for this specific purpose to the exclusion of other purposes. So too, this is a exclusive relationship. That's what the word Kiddushin represents. However, as we know, and this is where we'll have to pick up from tomorrow, we know that's not the whole story. Right? That we have Kiddushin, but the Jewish marriage does not stop with Kiddushin. Kiddushin is only the first step. And the second step is a very crucial part of the process, a very crucial part of creating the family relationship, and that's essentially what our Masechta gets into a little bit more, and we'll have to pick up with that tomorrow. It's just to quickly review what we spoke about today. So what did we see? So we saw that the Mishnah tells us that there is this concept of Knas. It's not the Mishnah, it's really the Pasuk, but the Mishnah starts off with the topic of Knas for Ma'anes, which the Torah tells us in Kisetze, that a ma'anes has to both be willing to marry the girl and to pay a knas. The idea of the knas is also found in Sefer Shmos, where we find it by pitoy, by seduction, and there the Torah connects it to kesef yishkol kamor ha'pesulos, which is going to be a crucial theme as we see. And then we started talking about the concept of kiddushin. The Torah says ki yikach yishisha. The Rambam understands that to be a mitzvah saseh, and that failure to do this before entering into a marital relationship constitutes an isser of kadesha. And that the Rambam explains in the Lo Saseh that the Torah needs this isser because the penalty that we're here talking about could create the impression that that's the whole story, that if you're willing to address that even through payment or through forgetting about it, then everything else is mutter, and therefore the Torah has to emphasize, no, that doesn't make everything else okay, that's a separate component, and there is this isser of kadesh. And we talked a little bit also about the Rambam, the Mor Nevuchim, who adds extra reasoning why it is the Torah has this commandment of seriousness in the relationships, so that children shouldn't be born into non-family structures, that women should have multiple children from many men, all kinds of different societal impacts, but so simply in Mishnah Torah it seems that the physical relationship has to have a seriousness of commitment. Then we spoke about how the Kenyan seems to affect that purpose. The Kenyan is a method of seriousness that we find B'chol Torah Kula, but it's not a Kenyan in the traditional merchandise sense. And we gave some examples about that, about the Rishonim saying that the Kenyan Hagbah is not going to be effective. And we talked about the issue of whether Kesef as a Kenyan, as a Kesef Shivyan, or a symbolic Kesef, and the Sma's point that it seems like it is a symbolic kind of Kenyan from the whole idea of Kiddushin, and we gave that whole point about Kenevus Das, about how that illustrates also how the model of monetary relationship breaks down when we take it too far in the marriage relationship, but the external protection of the monetary elements is a lot of what Ksubas is about. But first, the first step, Kiddushin, has this component of designation, this idea of Hektish, like the Gemara says in Kiddushin, and that Tosfos points out, this is unique to this relationship, it wouldn't work by business, it's a whole different kind of thing, but we see it's only the first step, and God willing, tomorrow we'll discuss the next step and how that impacts on our Misachra. Everyone should have a fantastic day. We'll try to head to the main gate of Toronto. It should be only good things.